Well, let's turn together to 1 Samuel 18. And if you're following in the Pew Bible, that is on page 241, 1 Samuel 18. So last week we studied probably the most famous passage, or one of the most famous passages in the Bible about David. He has other passages that are more, he's more infamous in those. You think of David and Bathsheba, but as far as a positive portrayal of David, I guess 1 Samuel 17 is probably near the top. His defeat of the Philistine champion Goliath. So this follows right after that, 1 Samuel 18. Listen to the word of God. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s." And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I, and who are my relatives, and my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private, and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.'" And Saul's servants spoke those words in the ears of David. And David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?" And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." Then Saul said, "Thus shall you say to David, 'The king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines.' that he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, as we come to this chapter in 1 Samuel, we see that Saul is still on the throne in Israel, even though we know that the Lord is going to replace him, and we know that he's going to replace him with David. So the question that remains to be answered as we're reading along is, how will this take place? How will the transition happen? How will the throne be passed from Saul to David? And it's actually at this point, you know, if you didn't know what happens, if you've never read 1 Samuel before, it's kind of a perplexing question. You know, Saul, on the one hand, he knows that the Lord has rejected him. He knows that the Lord is going to replace him. But Saul is not showing any signs of repentance, and he's not showing any willingness to step aside to make way for his replacement. On the other hand, David, he knows that he is the Lord's anointed, but David is not making any plans to overthrow Saul and install himself in his place. So how is the transition going to take place? Well, it becomes very clear that this transition from the rejected king to the chosen king is going to have to be brought about by the Lord's providential guiding of events. And of course, that's how everything ultimately takes place anyways, but that just becomes explicitly clear in the narrative here. So 1 Samuel 18 begins to unfold the story of how the Lord does this, how the Lord simultaneously brings about Saul's demise and David's accession to the throne. And really, in the remainder of 1 Samuel, we will see how David continues to rise in popularity in spite of Saul's efforts to destroy him, and actually because of Saul's efforts to destroy him in a certain sense. So the chapter begins by pointing out how Saul's son Jonathan was affected by the great faith and courage that David had exhibited in going up against Goliath. Now remember that Jonathan himself did not respond to Goliath's challenge. And that's surprising, as we pointed out last week. That's surprising when we remember how Jonathan had acted previously. And that we remember that he acted with such great faith and courage himself. He took his armor bearer and they went up against an entire garrison of Philistines back in chapter 14. But for some reason, Jonathan went along with his father and went along with the rest of the Israelites in letting Goliath's challenges go unanswered. Maybe his faith was growing weaker as he watched his father continue in this downward spiral. Maybe he was beginning to get a little jaded. Well, if that was the case, then David's actions clearly renewed Jonathan's faith. When he saw how David's faith in the Lord gave him the confidence to take on Goliath and to defeat him, Jonathan's soul was knit to the soul of David. He had found a kindred spirit. And you really see that when you compare those two stories. They both act in a courageous way because of their faith in the Lord. They are kindred spirits indeed. Now, it's unfortunate that I even have to mention this, but you may be aware that in recent decades, some liberal scholars have argued that David and Jonathan had, guess what? A homosexual relationship. And This is a perfect example of the kind of revisionist history that so often takes place these days. Instead of taking the time to listen to the text, to read it in its own literary and historical context, these interpreters simply read their own ideas back into the text. There is no reason to conclude that the text's assertion that Jonathan loved David means that this was a matter of same-sex attraction. How reductionistic is that? You know, that, I mean, really, anytime the word love comes up, it has to be sexual. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But listen to these words from Robert Gagnon. Robert Gagnon is a New Testament scholar. He teaches at a very liberal seminary, Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. I don't actually know how he keeps his job there, to tell you the truth, because he is the champion of the traditional understanding of what the Bible teaches about homosexuality. And he's written a number of books and articles on this. But listen to what he says about this passage and about what the Old Testament says about Jonathan and David. He says, "The statement that the soul of Jonathan was bound to the soul of David and Jonathan loved him as his own soul can be compared to the non-erotic kinship language of Genesis 44:31. Jacob's soul is bound up with his son Benjamin's soul." You see that it's very similar there. And then also Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." It can also be compared to formulaic treaty language in the ancient Near East, such as the address of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal to his vassals, "You must love me as yourselves." And the reference in 1 Kings 5:1 to King Hiram of Tyre as one who loved David. There's absolutely no reason to think that Hiram of Tyre had a homosexual attraction to David or anything like that. So that the revisionist homosexual interpretation of Jonathan and David's relationship is also a sad example of how our culture tends to view all love through a lens of eroticism. That's really the only category that our culture has for thinking about love. And this is tragic because it's resulted in a virtual inability to conceive of male friendships that are not sexual in nature. Our culture doesn't have a category for that. If you see two guys together enjoying one another's company, the first thing that people think, oftentimes, is, oh, they must be gay. And C.S. Lewis, this is not interesting, this is not a new thing either. It's been going on for a little while. C.S. Lewis points this out in his chapter on friendship in The Four Loves. He notes that while friendship was highly extolled by the ancients, it is ignored in the modern world. And even in Lewis's day, he wrote that it has actually become necessary to rebut the theory that every firm and serious friendship is really homosexual. And Lewis goes on to say that, you know, even if it's not expressed sexually, there's this latent homosexual attraction that's there. That's the way people think. And it is just, as I said, it's tragic and it's sad that so many people in our day can only think of love in those kinds of categories. And really, we need to resist that way of thinking. The Bible gives us plenty of examples of friendship, even friendships between men. And we need to let our thinking be shaped by what the Scriptures say rather than by the eroticized outlook of our culture. So as I said, it's sad that we even have to mention that when we study a passage like this, but that sort of thing is out there. It is the predominant way of looking at this passage from, you know, among liberal scholars. Well, the thing that especially stands out about Jonathan's love for David is that Jonathan had every reason in the world to hate David and to be jealous of David. As I read 1 Samuel, I am more and more impressed with Jonathan. What a man he was. Think of this. You know, Jonathan, previously, he was the one who was held in such high esteem by the people of Israel. And Israel was so devoted to Jonathan that they were willing to stand up to Saul. when Saul's rash vow put Jonathan's life in jeopardy. Jonathan's life was forfeit at that point, basically, because he had gone against what Saul had declared in that rash vow. It was a foolish vow. The people stood up to Saul because they loved Jonathan so much. And yet here, what do we see in this chapter? But we see that the eyes of the people are turning away from Jonathan, and they're turning to David, saying, wow, Jonathan, yeah, he's great, but now David, you know, he's the new focus that the people are looking on. And so David is really becoming a threat to Jonathan's path to the throne. And yet Jonathan is not at all jealous of David. On the contrary, he joins the people in honoring David. And his actions show that he recognizes that David is God's anointed. And it is deeply meaningful what he does here. As he takes off his robes, as he takes off his armor, as he takes his weapons, and he clothes David with them. It is very, very significant. The clothes, you know, we have the saying, the clothes make the man, you know. Well, it's kind of like that, actually. The clothes were symbolic of the person. In giving David his clothes, Jonathan was doing something extremely significant. He was transferring his rights as crown prince to David. That's what he's doing here. He's giving that up, and he's giving it to David. He is surrendering his rights in order to honor David above himself. And his actions foreshadow the transfer of the kingship from the house of Saul to the house of David. And they do it in this incredible way. Here we see that in God's providence, as God works this kind of love in Jonathan's heart, this kind of respect for the Lord's anointed, we see that Saul's rightful heir willingly gives up his claim to the throne and clothes David with his armor as an act of royal investiture. And so we see that David does not usurp the throne. He's actually entitled to it because Jonathan gives it to him here. Jonathan essentially is adopting David into his father's royal line, and he is willingly surrendering his status as firstborn to David. It's really an incredible thing. And we'll come back to that at the end of the sermon. Well, now we come to the second part of the chapter. The first part is about David and Jonathan. The second part is about David and Saul. And here we see Saul's attitude towards David. And Saul, we're told, is incited to jealousy when he hears this song that the women are singing in celebration of David's victory over Goliath. The women sang, "Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s." And when Saul heard those words, he took great offense at the fact that he was only attributed with defeating thousands, while David was attributed with defeating tens of thousands. Now, actually, it's not even accurate, you know, if you think of it that way. Because at this point, Saul had been a soldier. He had been a military leader for years. And David is just this, he's only defeated one guy, Goliath. That's it, you know. And so it's not even, you know, but and yet Saul insists on taking it literally. And the song was probably not at all intended to be an insult to Saul. It was not intended to exalt David over Saul. And you understand that when you understand how Hebrew poetry works. In Hebrew poetry, the key thing is not rhyme, but it's parallelism. And oftentimes when you have parallel lines, in the second line, the same thing is restated, but in an even bigger way to just reinforce the point that's being made. And so 1,000 and 10,000 in this song are not intended to be taken as literal figures. In Hebrew poetry, the second item in a set like this often increases the number simply for the sake of emphasis. Let me give you a couple of other examples of this. In Micah 6:7, so this is the verse before Micah 6:8. You know Micah 6:8. You know, he has told you, O man, what does the Lord require of you? Well, Micah 6:7 says this: "Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil?" And then another example in Psalm 91. You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. And so you see the parallelism there. Those are kind of similar parallels. And then 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. So again, the parallelism here is not intended to be taken literally. It's meant to be taken poetically. Saul should have maybe studied poetry. Maybe he wouldn't have had a problem here. Moreover, Saul was even given the first position in the song, the place of honor. He's named first, not David. And yet he still takes it to mean that David is 10 times the warrior that he is. And I think as we look at it that way, as we understand what's going on there, we realize that this song did not produce the jealousy in Saul's heart. Now, the song simply exposed what was already there. That's a good lesson for us, too. You know, when things provoke us to jealousy, it's not that those things actually create the jealousy. It's they're exposing what's already there. At least that's often the case, I think. Well, Saul's angry tirade after hearing the song of the women included a statement that was more significant than Saul realized. He said of David, "What more can he have but the kingdom?" Well, guess what? That's exactly what he's going to have. He's going to have the kingdom. Saul doesn't realize that yet, though. He doesn't know that David has been anointed as his successor, but he certainly feels threatened by him. And when David evades these attempts on his life that Saul makes in his state of madness, as Saul tries to pin him to the wall with his spear, Saul then puts him in a position of leadership in the army, and he's hoping that, you know, maybe this will result in David meeting his end on the battlefield. In all of this, though, Saul doesn't realize what he's really doing. He doesn't realize that he's really fighting against who? He's not fighting against David. He's fighting against the Lord. Saul's efforts here and his attempts to destroy David and how they continually are frustrated show us the futility of fighting against God. If you say, you know, I know that I should do this. I know that God's word tells me I should do this. But I'm going to do this instead because it's what I want. You know, that's fighting God. And if you do that, you will not find success. Not in the long run. And Saul, I think, is a good and a tragic example of that. Saul wanted to kill David by putting him on the battlefield, and what happens instead? Instead of getting David killed, David becomes more famous. David is given more opportunities to win the admiration and love of the people. And so Saul's attempts to destroy David only make him more popular. It's very ironic. And this becomes even more clear in the last section of the chapter, which describes how David came to be Saul's son-in-law. Saul had promised the man who defeated Goliath that he would have his daughter Merab in marriage. And yet, instead of giving her to David right away, Saul instructs him to continue proving himself on the battlefield. Probably he's secretly hoping that the Philistines will get rid of this guy for him. And David responds to this delay with humble dignity, though. He points out that he's unworthy to become son-in-law to the king. And yet when the time to give Merab to David arrives, Saul goes back on his word, and he gives her to someone else instead. But once again, we see that Saul's efforts are frustrated by the hand of providence. Saul reneged on his promise. He's not going to allow David to become his son-in-law. That would get him closer to the throne, after all. And yet now what happens? Well, now, in the Lord's mysterious working, Saul's other daughter falls in love with David. Saul's daughter, Michal, is in love with him. And Saul hears about this, and he sees, well, maybe there's an opportunity here. Maybe this is an opportunity to ensure David's destruction. And so he sets up this scenario here. He tells his servants to take advantage of David's humility. As David says, I don't even have a bride price that I can pay for the king's daughter's hand in marriage. And so the servants tell David, you know, it's not that much. It's only 100 Philistine foreskins. That's all. That's all. Not that much. And, you know, Saul is reasoning here. You can see his line of reasoning. The text even tells us. He's thinking he's going to kill two birds with one stone here. He knows David's a great warrior. Probably he's going to take out some Philistines. That'll be great for Saul. But then also, Saul reckons that 100 is far, far too great a number, too high to be attained. And so this will certainly be the end of David. That's Saul's thinking here. Wrong again, right? Wrong again. Once again, Saul's efforts against David are in vain. And David doesn't just bring back 100 Philistine foreskins. He brings back 200 Philistine foreskins. You know, consider what that tells us about the love that David must have had for Michal. You know, actually the text talks about Michal's love for David. It doesn't say anything about David's love for Michal here, but I think he exhibited it here. In this way. And it's a good thought for husbands to consider. You know, husbands, what did you do to win the hand of your wife? David got 200 Philistine foreskins. How about that? And so David's heroic deed leaves Saul with no choice at this point. He has to give him Michal. He has to keep his word. That makes David son-in-law of the king. And so David's path to the throne is getting more and more clear. And not only that, but David continues to enjoy success on the battlefield. And he's winning the esteem of the people. It just becomes very clear that Saul is fighting a losing battle. And I think that this just shows us what we read in Psalm 2, that the Lord laughs at those who set themselves against his anointed one. There is a real tragedy in the story of Saul, but there is actually this hint of even humor in it. It's just futile to try to fight against the Lord. Well, the story of David's path to the throne in Israel does foreshadow the coming of Christ, and Christ's path to the throne also. Just as David was opposed by Israel's king, Jesus was opposed by Israel's leaders. And John writes about this in the prologue to his gospel, where he says that Jesus came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Well, it's only by receiving Christ that we can obtain an inheritance in his kingdom. And receiving Christ involves forsaking self. And you know, Jesus said that explicitly. He said, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." And we see a really beautiful example of that in Jonathan. Jonathan, what does he do in this passage? He lets go of his life. He loses his life. He lets go of his claim on the throne. But in doing so, he binds himself in covenant to the one to whom God promised to build an eternal kingdom. And that is what we do when we receive Christ. When we forsake self and receive Christ, yes, we are losing our lives, but it is in doing so, in laying hold of Christ, that we save our lives in the sense that Jesus was talking about there. Thanks be to God for his grace to us in his Son.